everybody. It is 12:45 in the morning, and for some reason, I've decided that I need to record this because I just can't sleep. So, what's new? I tell myself daily that I need to try and go to sleep and change my routine and, you know, do all these things that everybody advises you do, meditation and, like, literally, I think I put a post on here a while ago about not sleeping, and there were so many suggestions, and I have genuinely tried them all, and nothing works. So if there are any other suggestions that you have, please feel free to get in touch, because I'm quite desperate. It's actually got to the point where I don't remember the last time I had a full night's sleep. I actually don't remember. I think it might be when I left teaching and I was pregnant with my first child. And I think it was that first night when I'd finished that job. And I think that was the only time I slept. I had this really great night of sleep where I wasn't having to worry about what I was doing the next day, or, you know, I just remember I used to go to bed, and even when I'd gone to bed in the early hours of the morning after finishing all that crazy workload that people say don't, you know, doesn't exist, I'd be lying there and straight away you'd have a child come into your head and something that you needed to do for the next day, or, you know, that job has a lot of cognitive load to it that people don't realise. So even when you're not physically working, your brain is always thinking and you can't switch off. And maybe there are some teachers who can, but I was definitely not one of them. But that isn't really why I've started recording. The reason I've started recording is because of a conversation my husband and I were having earlier, and he's just doing a few jobs at the moment. So I thought, hey, it's a good opportunity, isn't it? I can't sleep anyway, and I definitely can't settle while he's still kind of moving around. So I just thought, good use of time. Well, I'll probably regret it in the morning. And actually, it's tomorrow that has kind of triggered this. So I had an email last week from my son's school. There's an upcoming performance happening. And the teacher's concerned, very understandably, as am I, because he wants to participate in this performance. But we all know that he is likely to struggle with it, become triggered, and have a huge audience to, you know, to see what he can be like. I don't know how else to word it. I think the problem I have is I read and listen to so many advocates, and I say this and it always sounds like I'm being mean. I'm not at all, but a lot of them are childless, and they make you feel guilty for saying the things you say, like you're being a really awful parent. And the reality is, you're not being an awful parent, but these challenges are so real and they have an impact. They have an impact on you and your child and your family and everybody around you. And that's just the reality. So we all want to give him as many opportunities to succeed as we can. We don't want to take anything away from him that he wants to do. But at the same time, he is the most dysregulated child. And at the moment, he's going through a really bad phase. And you know, it's easy, isn't it, for people to say, well, that's telling you something, get on it. But it is so hard to sometimes get to the root of what is causing it, especially when you have a child who is very quick to react. You don't always know what the trigger is, and he is unable to tell you. I often talk about parent shaming, and I don't like it when people do it to other parents, but I feel like I've received an awful lot of it myself, and it feels so unjust because these people have no clue what I put into my children. And yes, it can maybe come across in the snapshots that I give, because even though I do share an awful lot of our lives, even though I share a lot about our life, I suppose, in general, collectively, it still is never going to adequately show you everything. It's just physically impossible. What I can tell you is, no matter how it might come across sometimes from things I say, there is so much love and acceptance in this home. It's outside of it that we don't experience it. But myself and my husband, we work so hard. I've said this before, and it's not just through the page. We work so hard through our jobs, our interactions with people, the things we independently do. We engage in volunteer work. There's just so much that we do to try and educate other people about neurodiversity and acceptance. And admittedly, some people, you know, find it a bit vulgar that I talk about our lives and our children. But we aren't doing it for negative reasons. We're doing it because we really want to try and help other people see what we're living through. Oh gosh, it sounds so awful. What the reality of our lives are. And a lot of that, again, is the fighting of the systems. It's the education, the health, the local authorities. It's other people. It's society in general. It's family. It's friends. It's all of that stuff. It's all the external stuff that makes it worse. But I'm also not going to pretend that even as a family unit, as a family of four, just living in this house without any of that stuff happening, that it isn't hard. Because the truth is, we have children who are not quite developing in a way that, you know, their peers are. And we're absolutely understanding of that because as two autistic people ourselves, we get it. We've been there as well. But our children are also PDAers. And I do go on about this. And the reason I go on about it is because it is such a different profile of autism. And it is such a different experience. And I think other people just cannot get their head around it. And I always say, I understand that. I understand if you have not lived this, it is really hard to comprehend. But that is where the challenges lie. But even without other people understanding, it is still hard. There is no way to consistently have success when you have children who are like that. And again, my husband and I have realised we just present a little bit differently. He was probably more in line with how our children present. I'm a little bit different. I'm, as I've already disclosed before, what you would call an internalised PDAer, because I've learned to internalise an awful lot of things. And I did do a post saying that I attended some of the PDA Space Summit 2022, and the Sally Cat video about internalised PDA, it was quite emotive for me, because you can just see so many parallels with your own life. And I've said before as well that I go in and out of believing I'm a PDAer. I scored highly when I was assessed, but it's still something that I was like, no, because I don't present like my children, I can't be, but I know I am. But it's a tricky thing. And I think I've said this before, when I completed the EDA QA, which is the adult, and, you know, obviously these tests are just indicators, they're not diagnostic tools. But when I completed that test, I scored really highly, and I had to be so honest with myself when I was completing those questions. And I think that was one of the turning points for me, was, wow, I have really learned to suppress a lot. And it's interesting, because some adult PDAers say, no, when you're an adult PDAer, it's impossible, you can't suppress. But it's not actually true. I still have those feelings. I still have those drives. I still have that awful feeling where I want to say certain things, but I've just learned that I can't. But the problem is, what I hadn't recognised was the toll that was kind of taking on me. And I'm not saying it's my right to say these things to people, everything that's in my head, but I've learned to internalise so much. And I've realised I do it daily, where, you know, I think my control now, where I place my control, is in trying to control myself. And some people say, well, you wouldn't be able to mask if you're a PDAer, but you can. And it's just, it's really difficult, isn't it? Because you have so many different PDAers, and we're not all the exact same, but somebody will try and apply their experience to your experience, and it doesn't make yours any less valid, which we've talked about here before. But it's tricky. And I think I've had a few days since I watched that video, and there's so many scenarios and things going on in my mind, and it's been quite overwhelming. And I want to kind of put all my thoughts on paper and share them here, but I'm just at the moment unable to process everything. So hopefully with some time that will come. But I am literally looking back to memories from very young, where I can see that these, you know, behaviours, I suppose, were there. And I just think it's like another grieving process. So when I realised I was autistic, I went through a bit of a grieving process of what if and reliving everything. When I was diagnosed formally, I was so surprised that I went through it again. And then now that I have, you know, really embraced the fact that, oh my word, I really am a PDAer, I feel like I'm going through it again, because I've got another level of understanding about myself, which is, you know, both wonderful and and really quite upsetting, to be honest with you. With all this in mind, I don't want to ever, ever make my children feel that they have to deny who they are. But the dilemma we're having is that my youngest in particular, he is just so extreme with his behaviour, his need for control, his meltdowns, his 0 to 100, that there are situations at the moment I don't feel he's ready for. And you just don't feel like you can really win. Because again, as I said earlier, you want to give him the opportunity to experience things. But at the same time, he's so unpredictable. It's a really, really difficult thing to decide upon. So we're at a place at the moment where he is due to take part in this performance. And the school have actually got a temporary one-to-one until his official one is put into place to take him away from this performance so he can do something different. But he doesn't want to do that. And my instinct is telling me that by the time the performance comes, he won't do it, because every single time that something has happened like this, he's always said at the very last minute, no, I don't want to do it. And there's usually a reason. But it's like, I don't know, I think he's cottoned on to the fact people are feeling anxious about him being a part of it. And I don't know, it's just so hard. I don't want to influence him. I don't want to make him feel like he can't do it. And also, if you tell him no, he'll just double down on it anyway. But I don't want people seeing that side of him. And in a way, we're now realising that we are, you know, as a school and as parents, that in some kind of way, we're trying to control how other people see him. Because we know people don't understand. And so I'm very wary of how I've worded that, because I don't want it to sound like it's us going, oh no, we're trying to hide him away from everyone. It's not that. But we're trying to protect him from the misunderstanding that will happen. And some people might suggest that we're trying to protect ourselves from the judgment. And there probably is an element of that too, if I'm being really honest. Because people don't understand his behaviour. They don't understand his triggers. And, you know, they do turn to us as parents. We've had that a lot over the years. And I feel like things are levelling out a bit for us, because we've been a lot more cautious about who we surround ourselves with, which I think is so crucial if you have a child who is different. But I do think particularly with PDAers, and I'm not saying that all PDAers are the same, because they're not, again, as I mentioned earlier, but we're in a bit of a horrible situation at the moment, because as another example, a lot of friends at school have invited him to parties and he can't attend them. He physically can't, even if he wants to. And that is because he is so easily triggered, and he has to control everyone. He is not playing in the same way that his peers play. And there are these really huge differences. And now the school and the local authority have said he's just too intelligent to, it's going to sound awful, but at this stage to be placed in a specialist setting, which would be probably a better setting for him in terms of his social, emotional and mental health needs. But academically, those schools don't really offer anything, and he doesn't want to be at home. He wants to be around children and friends. And this might change, and I'm not going to lie, there's a slight part of me where I'm hoping that the time will come where he is able to maybe be at home. It's a big pressure on me, but I feel so unhappy with the whole system. I feel unhappy with the specialist school system. And although this particular mainstream school is doing, you know, such amazing work with him, and they understand him and they really love him for who he is, and I'm so grateful, you know, instinctively we don't feel he's going to be there long term. But I also don't see specialist school as a viable option, and it is because they don't really seem to value the academic side. And there are some children who are capable, and he is one of them, and he's actually referred to as a high ability student. So in our minds, why would we put him somewhere where that is also not going to be embraced, I suppose, and harnessed? And so maybe long term the best place will be at home, but we'll have to wait and see. But for the time being, we just keep coming up against these same obstacles and barriers and experiences of My mum actually explained it, I suppose, better. I'm not sure if I can reword it, this what's the word, recall it the same way. But she said it's such a shame because he is such a lovely, lovely child. But when he goes, and he's unpredictable, and nothing works consistently with him. And the issue is, he's at mainstream, and they're making it work at the moment, and he does want to be there. However, what comes with that is the fact he's around mainstream children, being invited to mainstream parties and being invited to mainstream events, and there being obviously very mainstream things being held at the school, like this performance. But he isn't really mainstream. Not really. And he cannot participate in things like the other children. And again, I get that I'm not wording this brilliantly and people might pounce and say, well, of course he can. I know my child and it breaks my heart, but there are things he cannot access, not yet. It might change, but at the moment he is just so unpredictable. And as I also said earlier, you know, you have the armchair critics who, I just think it annoys me. It's so easy to be an armchair critic when you're not in a situation to go, oh, well, clearly it's this, or maybe try that. Or literally, we have tried everything. We have looked at it from every angle, every perspective, every possibility, every option. And there is no clear answer. It is just something that, you know, you have to know your child and you have to kind of try and provide these safe experiences for them. But it does break my heart that he can't go to parties. And he started to notice other children are going and he's not. And that's really, really filled me with guilt. But the truth is, because he does try to control all the other children, they tire of him. They don't want to play with him. And because he does escalate, and he escalates so extremely, it's not an easy thing for us to take him to a party. He cannot physically bend to anyone else. And so therefore, there are things that we just cannot physically do at the moment. And again, people will say, well, that's a choice. You could. You could go and risk him, you know, not triggering. But what I'm trying to explain is there is absolutely no situation at the moment in which he isn't triggering. And it won't end up being a successful experience for him. And I think maybe that's kind of really what I'm trying to get to the kind of crux of. It is not going to be a positive experience for him. It is another opportunity for him to fail. And some people will say, well, you're looking at it wrong. Maybe it's an opportunity for him to succeed. But we have consistently had all of these situations that we've tried with him and the school have tried with him, and he just ends up feeling even worse about himself. So what we need to try and do is create opportunities for him to have the experience, but on his terms. So one thing we considered was perhaps we throw a party and then we invite a few children and we keep it very small and manageable, and, you know, in a setting that he's happy to be in, but we then are very open and honest with the other parents. And again, some people will say, well, you shouldn't be doing that because then they're going to view your child differently. But he's become quite explosive recently, to the point he's been quite physical with other children. So we're having to be really, really careful with, you know, the way that we're handling things. And it's a really horrible position to be in because he can't help what he does when he's in that mode. But you cannot expect those children or their parents to understand that fully and to accept it when he is actually attacking their children. So I know people will then go back to the, well, there's an unmet need. Clearly there is. And we're all trying to get to the bottom of, you know, how to help him. And as I've said before, my answer was take him out of school. Take him out of school. Let's just get him at home. But he said it was the last thing he wanted. And I think we actually recorded that, you know, from his own mouth in another podcast. And then some people say, well, he's too small, you need to make the decision. You shouldn't let him decide. But then you've also got the emphasis on other people saying, no, 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 the children and young people need to have their voices heard. And I think this is where I always say you can't please everybody. Everybody has an opinion. And as much as I try so hard to explain the situations as, you know, clearly as possible, I know even now that I'm probably not explaining it to fully represent what the real situation is and what the real scenarios are, but I'm trying my best. But it is just absolutely heartbreaking, and we're trying so hard to help him, especially with his emotional regulation and things like that. But sadly, there's an awful lot of work to do. But in the meantime, what do we do to ensure that he, you know, is able to be around other children and that he is able to kind of have those needs fulfilled and to be able to feel like he is part of something and he belongs? And I think, like I said, how my mum worded it was brilliant. He already knows that he doesn't really belong. He wants to be there, and as long as he wants to be there, we'll do everything to support him. But there is a part of me hoping that at some point he won't. But I don't know how I could, even with him at home, duplicate the social stuff for him, because that's the bit he really loves. And he also loves the learning. And like, I can teach him, that's absolutely fine, but he loves those interactions with his teachers. But it's like he wants it on his terms. He wants that one-to-one that he can't have. And that's another thing he's struggling with at school, is not being able to have that one-to-one undivided attention from his teacher. When he puts his hand up, he wants to be asked. If he gets the answer wrong, he doesn't want his teacher to move on to anybody else. First of all, he can't stand being wrong, so he'll try and rewrite history and say he wasn't wrong in the first place, and he will try and get you to say that he wasn't wrong, or he'll, kind of then try and redo things, you know, because I sometimes do that with them, and I'll do like a rewind so they get another go at something, because they don't like to feel like they've done something wrong. And we try and teach all the time, mistakes are how you learn, there's nothing wrong with them. But again, they're not at a place yet where they can really fully embrace that. Now, when I was teaching, I found children from a very young age were able to access that, but my children just aren't there with their concepts and their understanding yet. And they will be at some point, I hope, but they're not there yet. So there are a lot of things that you can't communicate to them. And they might be able to listen and regurgitate things, but they're not really understanding of the concepts. So that's not really very helpful. But yeah, there are just a lot of things at school that he really does struggle with, and it's those elements. But actually, he is quite eager to please. He likes being around other children. He likes the teachers. He likes learning. So at the moment, it's not something that I'm happy to withdraw from him. But it would be very intriguing to see what happens moving forward. And I think, you know, we're on high alert all the time and monitoring. And like the biggest thing for us after what happened with our eldest, with his school-based trauma and all of the things that have come with that, is monitoring the mental health, really. You know, we want to make sure that they're emotionally safe and happy. So, but I suppose the one thing that at the moment we can't really control, and this is the hardest thing I think for all of us as parents, is the outside world. We cannot control what other people say, think, feel and do. And you know, that's the case for every parent. But I think in his case, because we do know what a lovely child he is, but how challenging he finds the world, and that's the only way I can explain it, it is just so heartbreaking. And so when people sometimes do get angry at parents like us for saying that things are challenging, or we're having a hard time, or our children are having a hard time, and they'll say, oh, you're just, you know, talking about autism or PDA as being this really bad thing and you need to embrace it. It's not about not embracing it. I do believe that maybe I need to record more and post more about some of the positives, because I admit I probably haven't focused on that as much. And that actually was the purpose of this podcast initially, was to celebrate neurodiversity. But I think, you know, our personal lives have been incredibly challenging. It has been such a difficult few years. So many parents out there will understand the constant having to educate others, fight others, have conflict. I mean, we're neurodivergent ourselves, so we're not really great with being around people anyway, and we've been forced into these positions and meetings and situations that we don't really want to be in. And then under the microscope, and it's just been hard in every way, you know? But yeah, parenting children who are different is tough. And it's like you're not allowed to say it because it somehow is painting your child as a burden, and it's somehow saying you don't love your child, and it's just so silly. You know, and the fact is, we are sometimes broken, we are sometimes drained and exhausted and tired of it all. And I've said it many a time before and I will continue to say it. I don't think there's anything wrong with sharing that. And part of this is so that people can not feel guilty if they feel the same way. You know, I hope that people listening to this who feel the same way breathe a sigh of relief that it's not just them. It's not just you. We all have these moments. I have moments where I am just so happy and in love with my little family, and I just think, wow, I'm so lucky. And, you know, I have a lot of those as well, so it's not all doom and gloom. But I have other days where I think, wow, I didn't expect this, and wow, can I keep doing this? Because everything is so hard. Everything is a battle, and I also do have a chronic health condition, but regardless, it's not easy. But I am going to end on something quite positive. So as you know, our eldest has been, he was referred at 2, and he's 7 now. And it's been a very, very long time coming, but he, you know, finally got assessed and all the rest of it. And we did go private for an autism diagnosis so that we could get some support with things like sensory OT and referrals and a few other things that have completely slipped my mind for some reason as I'm talking. But there were some things that were just not being taken seriously without the diagnosis. His EHCP was issued without diagnosis, but once we had the diagnosis, we found that there was again more cooperation, and people seemed to take it a bit more seriously. And it's a shame because you shouldn't have to kind of have it, but it definitely helped our case in many areas. However, we didn't actually inform the NHS that we'd gone and got this private ASD diagnosis because he'd already been referred to a team where they were going to assess other parts as well, that other comorbid conditions or coexisting concurrent conditions, because at the moment the language is all up in the air, because although comorbid was the word before, a lot of people don't like it, so I'm not sure which one at the moment is the preferred one. So, but we needed that stuff diagnosed, and, you know, we took the report to the appointment today to say, oh, we had the private autism diagnosis, but we didn't actually need to even show it, because after all of these years, we finally today had it officially formalised. So, okay, we already knew that they knew what his diagnoses were, because it's already been said to us 100 times or more over the years. But today he was formally diagnosed with autism, with a PDA profile, sensory processing disorder, Tourette's and ADHD. So, you know, it's been a long journey, and we had to do an awful lot of research and paperwork and appointments, and there's an awful lot of stuff we've had to do independently. It's been a lot of jumping through hoops and so much waiting. But we finally got there, and today it's now been formalised. So I'm really excited to kind of say that that's happened, and that even in the last few years, you know, dealing with local authorities and doctors, we have seen a shift probably in the last year or so in how these things are handled. We know that a lot of these doctors and case officers are backlogged and they're overloaded with work, and you know, I do empathize with that, I really do. It can't be easy for them, and so there does need to be some kind of solution they need to think of to try and deal with that backlog, because there are going to be many, many more referrals, and at the moment they are obviously not able to help them. But just to be positive, we have noticed that from our eldest to our youngest, that the process has been a lot better with their youngest. So I think that people are learning, and I do really believe that a lot of these organisations and professionals are trying to really help and to change a lot of their approaches and their beliefs. And it's not sadly across the board, but there is enough now that I'm seeing that is giving me hope for the future, that hopefully the waiting lists will reduce, that hopefully our children will be recognised, and hopefully we as parents will be believed and supported. I think that all of us out here sharing our experiences and all of us out there advocating for our kids and, you know, working hard to try and make these changes and to kind of educate the professionals, I suppose, who don't always take it well. But this one in particular did actually seem to acknowledge a lot of the stuff that I shared about my child, and they took it on board, and it was really nice to feel validated and not dismissed, to feel listened to and believed. We haven't really experienced a lot of that, and it was, you know, quite an emotive appointment, I suppose, really. So there are good changes happening out there. Sadly, it's not everybody's experience, but our experience was horrendous. It has been years of stress, of crying, of paperwork, and people don't realise what you mean. People can't imagine, you know, the stuff you're having to do. And for many of us, that will carry on for a very long time. So as a very quick example, I have a friend who has older children, and I was having a chat with her today. And of course, you know, when she was talking to me about her teenagers, older teenagers, and the EHTPs and all the things that she's having to put into place for them, it just really dawned on me that, wow, this is going to be a lifetime of this. This isn't just a couple of years while they're young. This is literally now going to be every year until I think it's 25. And from what I gather, it gets actually harder to get the support as they get older, but I'm not there yet. I don't know firsthand, but just from speaking to other people, it has actually overwhelmed me a little bit. So, but hopefully if there are changes happening and we are trying to, you know, support children and families, and if there is genuinely more education and acceptance about autism out there and how it presents differently, for example, with a PDA profile, which is one of my biggest passions about getting people to really understand that aspect of things, because there are still so many professionals who don't want to put their neck on the line. We have been to two separate professionals who saw clear pathological demand avoidance traits and even said that to us in appointments, but they wouldn't commit it to paper. We're very, very happy that the consultant in the end finally, you know, diagnosed it, because they recognized it, and from all the evidence we provided as well, they were like, you know, it's undeniable. So that was brilliant. But, you know, to have two other professionals who refer to it but don't actually spell it out in the paperwork because they don't want to upset the community of other health professionals, and that's what we were actually told. You know, there's still an awful lot more work to do, but I feel like things are going in the right direction. So fingers crossed that change is on the horizon and that things are going to start getting better over the coming years. And I think with things like the national strategy, autism strategy and all that kind of thing in place, and with all the training that's kind of being, the mandatory training that's being, I think, branched out. I'm losing all my words again, but I know by this point, you know, I struggle with processing. So apologies if I've got any of the words wrong. I always cringe afterwards and think, why did I say that? But I just forget in the moment. It's so frustrating. That's why I prefer writing. But sometimes that's too much of a demand, and it's just easier to do this and just talk. So yeah, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for listening, and speak soon.